I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Larry Mueller today, you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on WPR News. And last hour, we had a couple of executive chefs in our studio, experts in their own field, who, when I told them we were talking about fermentation this next hour, they both told me that we should be talking to Sandor Alex Katz. Well, our guest for this hour is the one that executive chefs point to as the expert, the revivalist, the one who knows fermentation arguably better than anybody else. Sandor Alex Katz is a James Beard Award-winning author. His books include The Art of Fermentation, and if you have questions about fermenting at home, or if you've got suggestions, you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org. And Sandor, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be with you today.
And it's an honor to have you. Can you just share your story a little bit and how you came to the fermenting process and why it's so important to you?
Well, sure. I mean, there were definitely a few steps in the development of my interest in fermentation. I grew up in New York City as the grandchild of immigrants from Eastern Europe. And I grew up eating a lot of pickles. And the pickles that we were eating in New York were fermented pickles, basically cucumbers in a saltwater brine with garlic and dill and maybe other seasonings, fermented. I didn't know about that as a kid, but I was very strongly drawn to the flavor that I could now describe as the flavor of lactic acid. Mm. Then in my mid-20s, I spent a couple of years experimenting with a macrobiotic diet. And macrobiotics places an emphasis on the digestive benefit of pickles and other kinds of live fermented foods. And I started observing that whenever I would eat pickles, and I mean, frankly, now even just talking about them, I could feel my salivary glands under my tongue squirting out saliva. And I really began to associate these foods with, good digestion and good health. But really, the catalyst for me to begin exploring how to ferment food was when I moved from New York to rural Tennessee, where I've lived for the last 33 years. And I started gardening. And, I was such a naive city kid, it had never occurred to me that in a garden, all of the cabbages would be ready at about the same time, all of the radishes would be ready at about the same time. And that first year that I was gardening, when I recognized this, I had this question, what do we do with all this? And then I had this sort of epiphany where I realized that, sauerkraut that I'd been eating my entire life, the pickles that I loved so much as a kid, these were actually practical strategies for preserving vegetables. Sauerkraut was really my gateway into fermentation. I learned how to make sauerkraut from the joy of cooking. It is ridiculously simple. You shred cabbages, you salt them, season them with other flavorings if you like. I like to get in there with my hands and squeeze them for a minute or two until they're juicy. And then the idea is you pack them tightly into a jar or a crock or a bucket or whatever your vessel is until they're submerged under their own juices. And it's in this protected condition that the lactic acid bacteria come to dominate every single time. And as they acidify the vegetables, they become more stable, they become more delicious, and they become safer. It really piqued my interest, and I started, learning how to make yogurt, how to make country wines out of blackberries and other kinds of abundant fruits. And, over the course of a few years, I just became obsessed with all things fermented, and that obsession continues to this day.
And Sandor, what would you like folks to know who don't ferment at home? What about the fermentation process would you like to share with everybody? What is it that you would wish, at the very least, that they would know and understand?
Well, I mean, first of all, I can't tell you how many times I've met a stranger. They ask what kind of work I do. I tell them that I teach and write about fermentation, and then they make this face like that's the most disgusting thing in the world, and they say, "Oh, I hate fermented foods." You know, and then I just have to respond to them and say, oh, poor you. What a restricted diet you must have. You know, no bread, no cheese, no cured meats, no condiments, no chocolate, no coffee. You know, an incredible number of everyday foods are produced by fermentation, and pretty much every person in pretty much every part of the world eats and drinks products of fermentation just about every day. So, I mean, fermentation is casually part of everybody's life, even if they're not thinking about it. Now, you know, because we have been taught to be so fearful of bacteria, a lot of people project their anxiety about bacteria onto the idea of fermentation. And I guess what I would want to emphasize above all else is that fermentation is a strategy for safety. Fermentation makes food safer. It is not, you know, a dangerous process. And a lot of people imagine that it's high tech and it requires special facilities. And, you know, to anyone who's, you know, the least bit interested in experimenting with fermentation at home, what I would say is, you know, most of these processes are incredibly simple. And if you want to do them at home, they're easy to do at home. And that's what my books are all about. You know, my first book was Wild Fermentation, and that's generally where I would recommend that people start. You know, you can do it. It's simple. It's safe. It's fun. It's delicious. It's supportive of good health. And it really has everything to recommend it.
Sandor Alex Katz, our guest, the author of Wild Fermentation, The Art of Fermentation, a fermentation revivalist and expert, taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234, where we'll talk to Dwayne in Westfield next. Dwayne, good afternoon.
Hey, how you doing today? I'm not much on, the fermenting, but I don't know if the rest of the viewers didn't quite understand that one of the biggest condiments in the world that we use every day was actually started out as fermented fish.
Well, sure. So, yeah, I mean, the ketchup that's, you know, in pretty much every American
Wait a minute.
Home.
How do we get from fermented fish to ketchup, Sandor? That was quite a leap.
Well, you know, just through these cultural reinterpretations. So it's, you know, ketchup is, you know, like a word that was used in and still is used in parts of Indonesia to describe fermented fish. And it also, a similar word was used in China to use fermented fish sauce. And then, you know, as condiments spread around the world, ketchup got reinvented in the UK as a walnut-based condiment. And then later in North America, it was further reinvented as our beloved tomato-based condiment. But let me just talk a little bit about about condiments.
Yes.
Like the ancient condiments of the world, things like fish sauce, things like soy sauce, you know, are produced by fermentation. All of our contemporary condiments, not only ketchup, but mustard, mayonnaise, chutneys, salsas, they rely upon vinegar as their stabilizer. Vinegar is a product of fermentation. You know, the whole range of condiments that we enjoy rely upon fermentation.
Dwayne, that was brilliant. I really appreciate connecting the ancient fish sauce all the way to our modern day, very sugary ketchup that is on the kitchen table.
And by the way, there are all kinds of people who are making fermented ketchups. I mean, you know, you can make a wholesome ketchup.
Yes.
Starting with some tomato sauce and, you know, whatever other flavoring ingredients you want to add. And then you can ferment that and you can make it with as little or as much sugar as you like. But, you know, definitely there are people who are making kind of, you know, fermented versions of ketchup today.
So, Sandor, if I wanted to start a fermenting process at home, what would be the easiest vegetable to grab, or where would you suggest we start, and what kind of ingredients would I need to have on hand, and how what's the time it would take to get something that I could taste?
Well, I mean, you know, really the process for fermenting vegetables is incredibly versatile. And, you know, I mean, cabbages and, you know, cucumbers might be the most famous ones, but, you know, any kind of vegetables you like, you could ferment. I would say to the easiest thing for people to start with would be something sauerkraut style. And by sauerkraut style, I mean dry salting. We don't add any water to the vegetables. So it's about creating surface area, chopping or shredding the vegetables. And, you know, that can be as finely or as coarsely as you like. They don't all have to be a consistent coarseness. I always, when I make sauerkraut with groups of people, I always say chopper's choice, and some of them are finer and some of them are coarser. It really doesn't matter. But the surface area enables us to draw water out of the vegetables. And when we salt the vegetables, and by the way, there's no magic number of how much salt. A lot of people use as a guideline 2% salt, but, you know, there's nothing set in stone about that. I actually prefer to use less salt than that. So for people who are trying to moderate their salt intake, that's no problem. You salt the vegetables. The salt starts to draw water out of the vegetables. You can add any other kind of seasonings you like, whether it's caraway seeds or dill or garlic or onions. You can mix different vegetables together. I often like to mix green cabbage, red cabbage, and carrots all together. But the your objective is to get them juicy and salt them to taste. Like, we don't all have the same taste for salt. And then once they're salted to your liking and they're nice and juicy, my test for this is I hold a small handful up above the bowl, squeeze, and if a little bit of juice comes out like a wet sponge, then you're in business. And then you just pack that into a jar. Everybody has jars around. A wide mouth jar is a little bit easier to deal with than a more narrow neck jar. But just do it in a jar if you're just starting out. You know, once you discover how much you love it, then, you know, maybe you want to invest in a crock and make larger quantities. But, you know, a quart jar will take approximately 2 pounds of vegetables to fill. And then you just press them down so that they're submerged under their liquid. I like to use one of the big outer cabbage leaves with a spine. Use that spine like a little spring to just hold the vegetables down under the juice. And then you just wait. And there's no magic number of how long to ferment it. You know, the point to understand is lactic acid develops over time. And some people prefer a milder flavor, which would mean you ferment it for a shorter time. If you like a stronger, more pronounced acidity, you can ferment it for a longer time. So, I mean, I recommend that people start tasting it after 4 or 5 days.
Oh.
Then press it down, ferment it a few more days. And then you familiarize yourself with the spectrum of flavors that are possible. And, you know, if one day you taste it and you think, wow, this is getting strong, I want to slow this down, move it into your fermentation slowing machine, which is your refrigerator. And then it'll just be stable for, you know, months and months in the refrigerator. And you can just eat it at your leisure. But probably you'll like it so much, you'll eat it up and need to make some more.
Am I storing it in a dark, cool place or before I put it in the fridge? Where am I keeping this in the meantime?
Well, yeah, sure. You want to keep it out of direct sunlight, mostly because sunlight degrades nutrients. It won't prevent the fermentation from happening. But don't hide it. Like, the last thing you want to do is forget about it. So I think it's really important to, you know, keep it in your visual field. I like to keep it on my kitchen counter. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is a little bit of carbon dioxide will be formed as a byproduct of the process, especially in the earliest days. And, you know, in the morning when I'm making coffee, I just loosen the lid, let that carbon dioxide pressure that's built up out. I press down to make sure the vegetables at the top are getting fully submerged. And then I always taste my fingers to gauge how the flavor is developing.
The basics are so basic, it makes me wonder why anybody buys sauerkraut at the grocery store.
I wonder the same thing. I want to say one other thing, which is any food can be fermented. There's nothing we could possibly eat that cannot be fermented.
That sounds like a
challenge. Every kind of food can and is fermented.
Sander Alex Katz, our guest, fermentation revivalist and expert, James Beard award-winning author of such books as Wild Fermentation, The Art of Fermentation, and your questions about fermentation are welcome here, whether they be basic or at the expert level, Sander can handle it all. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. And Larry returns tomorrow with a look at how our emotional health is connected to the way we age. Also, we'll hear the story of how becoming a grandparent can change your perspective on life and new alcohol guidelines you need to know about, all coming up tomorrow with Larry Mueller starting at 11 o'clock. Right now, our guest is fermentation expert Sander Alex Katz joining us. He's the author of The Art of Fermentation, Wild Fermentation, Sander Katz's Fermentation Journeys, Fermentation as Metaphor, which makes me curious. But first, I want to get to your calls and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or talk@wpr.org. We'll go to Susan in Fitchburg next. Susan, good afternoon.
Hi. I'm wondering if a person gets the same health benefits from eating sauerkraut in a can or in a jar, or you can get it in the refrigerator section in a plastic bag.
Yep.
I'm wondering, would you get the same benefit as if you make your own sauerkraut? And the same with pickles. If you buy pickles, are you going to get the same benefit, the health benefit, that you would if you made your own pickles?
Great question. Sander, sometimes I bristle at buying sauerkraut in the store because of the price tag. Some of the pickles that are in the refrigerated section seem a little too expensive for my taste. I'm wondering, are they any less healthy? Certainly, I believe we could do them for less cost.
Well, okay. So there are a variety of different kinds of sauerkraut and pickles that are commercially available. And, they're prepared in very different ways. And, they have, different potential health benefits. So, fresh, raw sauerkraut is teeming with probiotic bacteria. And that's one of the reasons that so many people have become interested in eating, sauerkraut and other kinds of live fermented foods. It's to, enrich the microbiome and, improve biodiversity, and that can potentially improve digestion, improve overall immune function. And there's even some new evidence that it could improve mental health. And, who can't benefit from improved digestion, improved immune function, and improved mental health? Now, when you see sauerkraut that's in a can in the refrigerator, in the supermarket, like anything that's in a can is no longer alive. It is through high heat processing that food can be stabilized in a can. And, there is a place for that. It's a wonderful tool in our toolbox for food preservation. But, qualitatively, that food is somewhat diminished, both from a nutritional standpoint, because high heat diminishes vitamin C and certain other nutrients, and in terms of, these live bacteria that can have, a probiotic benefit for our bodies. So, in general, I would say that, those ones you're finding in the refrigerated section that are a little bit more expensive or a lot more expensive, mm-hmm, are definitely going to, have, more of, they're generally still going to be alive. Now, there's some bagged sauerkraut that's not, and some that is. I'll tell you that any product that is unpasteurized and alive is going to tell you that on the package, because, that's the fact that makes it worth more money to people. Now, in terms of making it yourself, I would say it's even better to make it yourself. I would say, anytime I hear people, complaining about the price of a jar of live sauerkraut in a store, you know, I challenge them to make it themselves. I mean, the ingredients, even if you buy organic ingredients, are going to cost you less than a couple of dollars for a pound of sauerkraut.
Yeah.
That might cost as much as $10 in a store. So absolutely, by all means, make it yourself.
You
want more control over the process. It'll be fresher. You can figure out what kind of seasonings you like. You can make it the way you like it. No reason not to. Now, pickles.
Yes.
Pickles is a big category. So a pickle is anything preserved in an acidic medium. Now, you know, the pickles that fill contemporary supermarket shelves, generally not in the refrigerated sections, are pickles that have been made by pouring a hot vinegar solution over the vegetables. And so because it's a hot vinegar solution poured over the vegetables, it's no longer a living food. It's not teeming with bacteria the way the fresh pickles of my youth were. So a pickle is anything preserved in an acidic medium. We can accomplish that in a variety of ways. You can pour vinegar over something, and it's, you know, it's not just cucumbers that people pickle. People pickle beets, people pickle pig's feet, people pickle eggs. I mean, a lot of things can be preserved through pickling by pouring a hot vinegar solution over them. But raw vegetables can be pickled by just putting them in a saltwater brine solution. And these are the pickles that I grew up with. These are the pickles that generally you're going to have to pay a lot more for at the market because they have to be kept cold. I mean, you know, nobody's profiteering and getting rich off of selling pickles. It's just that, you know, the cost of maintaining a product under refrigeration is much greater. So I would always say do it yourself. Like none of it is rocket science. You can figure it out. For fermenting cucumbers, you know, there's a little bit more technique involved because it's easy for them to get soft and mushy, especially in warm weather.
Okay.
When cucumbers are ripe. So keeping it cool is the most important thing. And then there's a variety of techniques that I explore in my books, from, you know, adding tannin-rich leaves like grape leaves to them, making sure you work with really fresh cucumbers, scraping off any residue of the blossom end of each cucumber, using a strong brine. I usually use a 5% brine solution, meaning that for a liter of water, I would use 50 grams of salt, which is about 3 tablespoons of salt per quart. So there's a variety of techniques that can, you know, help keep your, you know, cucumbers crunchier, your pickles crunchier. But if you're concerned about, if you want those probiotics, then definitely you don't want to be eating the unrefrigerated versions of these foods. You want to either make them yourself or pay the premium and, you know, get the varieties that you'll find in the refrigerated section of the market. And generally, these will tell you that they contain live bacteria.
Sandor, this came up last hour with our executive chefs, and the question about the salt. Does it matter what salt you use or the quality of salt, or does that not ultimately matter in the fermentation process?
Well, I mean, you know, it's really fun to try different varieties of salt. You know, different kinds of salts have different flavors, different mineral balances. A lot of the literature tells people to avoid using iodized salts for fermentation. The reason for this is that, you know, in a high concentration, iodine will definitely kill bacteria. But, you know, the amount that's added back into salt is really so little. And, of course, unrefined sea salts always have traces of iodine. So I don't worry about it. I mean, I love to work with unrefined salts. But for strange reasons, unrefined salts, which take much less work, cost 10 to 100 times as much as refined salts.
Sure.
So, the last thing I want anyone to think is that they have to go buy some special variety of salt in order to, you know, ferment some sauerkraut for their family. You can use whatever kind of salt is in your kitchen, you know, and if you're someone who has lots of different varieties of salt, experiment. Try it with different salts. They each have a different character. And, that's a really, fun way to vary it and mix it up.
What are some of the other spices that you like to put into some of the things that you ferment, Sandor?
Well, I love caraway seeds in sauerkraut. Mm. When I make pickles, I mean, there's no such thing as too much garlic. I love garlic. I love dill. Mm-hmm. I make a lot of kimchi that's spicy. I like to use chili peppers in that, as well as garlic, ginger, scallions. But I also love to play around. Like, I've had some amazing curry krauts where you use turmeric and cumin and other kinds of curry flavors. Sometimes people like to make kraut, based on the flavor profile of a Salvadoran salad called curtido. And they use oregano and cumin. And that's delicious. Really what I would say is, like, your imagination is the only limitation. Once a young woman at a workshop presented me with some sauerkraut she had made with minced vanilla beans in it.
What?
And it was delicious. It never would have occurred to me in a million years, but it was delicious. Sometimes people will add in some kind of a cooked element. I met a woman whose grandmother was from a town in Poland where everybody bulked up their sauerkraut with mashed potatoes.
Hmm.
As long as there's something raw in there and you add the cooked element after it's cooled, the bacteria, on the raw cabbage, will ferment the mashed potatoes as well. And that's a really delicious, kind of weird combination. Actually, a chef I met up in Wisconsin shared with me a recipe for a sauerkraut chocolate cake.
That sounds uniquely Wisconsin. I'd be interested in finding out more.
Where the sauerkraut, keeps it moist,
uh-huh,
and provides acidity to react with the baking soda to rise the cake.
Oh.
And you would never know. Unless somebody told you, you would never know that there was sauerkraut in it. Sauerkraut has a lot of applications. Many people mostly want to eat it raw, but there's incredible ways of cooking with sauerkraut. There's a Polish dish called bigos, where you basically stew meat in sauerkraut. Of course, sauerkraut pierogies. There's a beautiful Hungarian-style sauerkraut soup that I love to make. It's a very versatile food.
You mentioned Wisconsin, Sandor Alex Katz. So we are the dairy state, and we can't skip over fermenting dairy and the ways to go about making yogurt in our own home. Can it be done?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, yogurt is very, very straightforward.
Hmm.
I would say there's more complexity to it than making sauerkraut.
Mm-hmm.
But it is absolutely something that is easy to do in the home. The complexity of it is that it involves a little bit of temperature manipulation. Generally, people like to heat the milk up to about 180 degrees and then cool it down to about 115 degrees, introduce the cultures at that moderately warm temperature, and then try to maintain the temperature above body temperature. So the way I do that is that I just use a small insulated cooler that, usually people might take, beer or sandwiches,
sure,
somewhere to keep them cool. But instead of putting ice in to make it cool, I add a little bit of hot water in to make it warm. And then I heat up the milk in a sort of double boiler situation. I put a smaller pot inside of a larger pot, just so I don't burn the milk. And then I heat it up to about 180 degrees. This is really important because it denatures the proteins. And that's what, I mean, one of the magical things about yogurt is it transforms, you know, 1 quart of liquid milk into 1 quart of yogurt. And so in order to transform a liquid to a solid without removing any of the liquid, the way this happens is that the bacteria restructure the proteins. Like, proteins all have a physical structure, and there are various ways of manipulating them. And one of the ways is that certain bacteria can restructure the protein. But if you don't heat the milk first, and so the proteins are not denatured, then it just will never get very thick. You'll have a very runny yogurt, and I really appreciate a thick yogurt. So there's this little bit of temperature manipulation involved. I use a thermometer. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, you know, people would just learn. They just by doing it, like, train their fingers to recognize the key temperature. So I heat it to about 180, then I lower it to about 100, then I cool it off to about 115. You don't want to add the cultures when it's warmer than that, or they'll be killed by the heat. But they need higher temperatures. Like the yogurt cultures are called thermophilic cultures because they're only active at temperatures higher than body temperature. Now, for the starter itself, I mean, the classic way is you use some old yogurt. So, you can just go to the store and buy plain whole milk yogurt and use that as the starter to make some yogurt. Now, the contemporary commercial yogurts are made from pure culture starters, which is really a departure from the history where, it was just continued by feeding the previous batch to make the next batch, mm-hmm. and then saving some of that to make the following batch. So, you know, if you can get your hands on what I would describe as an heirloom yogurt culture, it'll be much more stable over the long haul than, using a commercial yogurt made from a pure culture starter. But the process of making it is pretty straightforward. I make about, 2 quarts of yogurt, maybe every 2 months.
Okay.
And I generally make it in 4 pint-sized jars. Because, if you have one big jar and you slowly use it, when there's more and more airspace in there, the yogurt can begin to have more of a yeasty flavor. So I prefer to do more smaller jars rather than a single large jar.
I should mention, Sandor, your website is wildfermentation.com, and we'll have a link to that on our section of the webpage with this interview at wpr.org/Larry. It's wildfermentation.com, and I think I saw that you can create your own starter out of bread on your website. Is that right?
Well, sometimes I post, other people's ideas. I have never tried to make a yogurt starter out of bread.
Okay.
I really like just using the previous batch. In our English language, we have a really vivid word for this idea of you use the previous batch as the starter for the next batch, and that word is backslopping. But, there's all kinds of folklore in different regions of the world about different botanical starters for making yogurt. The latex that comes out of fig leaves is one of them.
Wow.
Various kinds of plants. The stems of chilies is something that people in India sometimes use as a starter for making dahi, which is the classic Indian style yogurt. I should also just point out that yogurt is not a singular food. Yogurt is a word that we have come. It's a Turkish word that we have come to use to describe a vast range of styles of fermenting milk. You know, the fresh milk that we grew up with was not a possibility for anyone who didn't have a cow or a goat, where they lived, until the advent of the widespread adoption of refrigeration. Mm. So fermented milk, you know, the vast majority of the milk that people have consumed throughout history and today has been fermented forms of milk, and that's not limited to yogurt. There's other styles of fermented milk. I mean, another famous one is kefir, but there's, you know, literally thousands of distinctive local styles of fermented milk. And of course, almost all cheese is fermented as well. Sure. And the distinction with cheese being that you're removing some of the watery element, you're removing the whey, and you're making something denser. And so, you know, it's easier to preserve denser things, let's say like cheddar style cheese or Parmesan style cheese, than it is to preserve more watery things.
Sandor Alex Katz, our guest, fermentation revivalist and expert author. His website, I'll give out again, wildfermentation.com. And running out of time for your questions for our guest, 1-800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Don't forget to pick up your free tickets to Larry Mueller broadcasting live at the Garden and Green Living Expo in Madison coming up just a week from Friday. So do not wait to get these tickets. They will also get you in the door for the Garden Expo. Just go to wigardenexpo.com for your free tickets and your second to last chance to see Larry Mueller broadcasting live. It'll actually be the last opportunity in southern Wisconsin before we take our show to Bayfield in Bloom here in just a couple of months. So be sure to catch that online again, wigardenexpo.com. With the time we have left, our guest, Sandor Alex Katz, fermentation revivalist, and your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234. We'll go to Dennis and Cudahy next. Dennis, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for all the tips on the fermentation. I can cucumbers, asparagus, beets, but I use a cold process where I have to keep them in the refrigerator. The refrigerator pickles are, instead of boiling them to seal the jar. Do I lose some nutritional value by putting them in the jar and boiling it to seal the can? My pickles are very popular. They're nice and crisp. I think when I put them in a hot bath, it takes away the crispness in the pickles. What is your opinion?
Sandor?
Well, I mean, I certainly agree that a cold pack pickle like he's describing, a refrigerator pickle, you know, it certainly, to me, it always has a, you know, better flavor, better texture. You know, I've never really seen any information. I don't know how hot he's making it. I couldn't really speak to whether there's any diminishment of the nutrients. But, you know, if you're bringing it up to boiling temperatures at all, you know, I can tell you that the one nutrient that's very sensitive to heat is vitamin C. Mm. If you're bringing it to any kind of a boil, chances are the vitamin C is diminished. But, contemporary Americans, for the most part, we're not lacking for vitamin C. I mean, I wouldn't worry about it. I mean, I would encourage you to, you know, experiment with some, fermented pickles. To me, they're just so much more delicious. And it's just like, it's a different acid. One is acetic acid is what vinegar is. Lactic acid is what develops when you ferment vegetables, and they have very different flavors. They're both acidic, but the particular flavors are different. And, you know, just from having been raised with fermented pickles, you know, I strongly prefer the lactic acid flavor, but I've never met a pickle I didn't like.
I really appreciate how scientific this is, but how artistic you make it, Sandor, and how much room there is to try and, well, and you know.
Let me say something about science, yeah. Okay? Because, you know, people hear bacteria, they think science. You know, you need a microscope, you need a laboratory. You know, microbiology has certainly illuminated fermentation. And, you know, we have a much clearer understanding of what is happening in this process. But, you know, none of the people who figured out how to make sauerkraut, how to make yogurt, how to make wine, how to make beer, you know, how to make any of the, you know, beloved fermented foods or beverages that we enjoy, none of them specifically knew about the existence of bacteria. You know, you don't need to understand the science in order to effectively and safely ferment food in your home. What you need is to just understand the conditions you're trying to create. With fermenting vegetables, it's getting the vegetables submerged. With making yogurt, it's this little bit of temperature manipulation. You know, I just really liked, I mean, sure, science, I mean, I've totally geeked out learning about the science of fermentation,
but you're like, not a rocket scientist, right?
I am not a rocket scientist. I'm not a microbiologist, and you know, you don't need any of that in order to, you know, ferment really delicious and really healthful foods in your kitchen.
Let's go to Joe in Duluth next. Joe, good afternoon.
Hi. I can pickles. Make dill pickles by a hot brine over the cucumbers with other ingredients in there. My mother used the same recipe that I do. She would end up then, even though the pickles were in a sealed jar, that they would, some of hers, a minority, maybe 2 out of 5 would ferment in the jar, kind of bubble out over the top, have a sediment on the bottom. The pickles turned out hollow inside, kind of popped when you ate them, and were delicious. I've never been able to get any of my pickles to ferment like that once they're in the hot brine and in the jar. Do you have any comments?
Sandor?
Well, I mean, I have really no experience with, you know, sort of hot bath pickling. You know, I would say that if your mother did a hot bath pickling and it started to ferment, something in the process didn't go right. Because the whole objective of that hot bath is to make sure that the bacteria in the vegetables are destroyed. And that's really the, you know, the logic behind all canning of food. You know, I would just recommend if you want to ferment cucumbers and you know, create that, you know, incredibly delicious flavor of lactic acid cucumbers, like just eliminate the hot bath and sort of just completely alter the approach and, you know, just do the whole thing, you know, at room temperature.
Yeah, this raises an interesting question. What are some of the common ways that fermenting can go wrong, Sandor?
Well, I mean, so in the realm of fermenting vegetables, I mean, it's about as safe as food gets. Mm-hmm. You know, there's really, in the United States, there's really no case history of illness or food poisoning from fermented vegetables because, you know, the acidity is so protective. Like, you know, for commercial businesses fermenting vegetables, the regulatory authorities require them to test the pH of each batch. And the number that the regulatory authorities are looking for is 4.6. But if you get your vegetables to a pH of 4.6 or below, which generally happens within just a few days, you know, then it is, you know, broadly understood that nothing dangerous, no salmonella, no E. coli, you know, or other food poisoning organisms can grow in there. And, you know, there's definitely not even a theoretical possibility of botulism with, you know, fermented vegetables. The things that generally can go wrong, I talked about getting the vegetables submerged. Well, whenever you submerge something under liquid, there's a surface. And, the submerged vegetables are protected from air and aerobic organisms, but oftentimes the surface is exposed to air, and that's really where most of the problems with fermenting vegetables occur. Mm-hmm. And you can get a little surface growth that's called calm yeast, totally harmless, but sometimes it freaks people out. And I've met dozens of people who have thrown away really perfectly good batches of sauerkraut because of this little sort of white film of calm yeast that develops on the surface. Occasionally I've heard of like a hairy white mold developing, also generally regarded as harmless. I would just remove that. And if there's a top layer of the vegetables that feel a little bit soft as a result of that growth, get rid of that, and what's underneath it is going to be fine. Honestly, my worst failures fermenting vegetables have been when I have failed to adequately protect the surface from flies. And, if a fly gets on the surface of there and lays some eggs, then you might have a rude surprise when you go to harvest your sauerkraut, and you could have some, you know, little wormy maggots crawling out. So the lesson there is, you know, just make sure you protect these things from flies. And so, you know, if it's not in a jar that's sealed or a crock that has a firm lid, then just use a finely woven cloth secured by a string or rubber band just to make sure that flies can't get into it.
Sandor, I just have a couple minutes left, but I am very curious about one of your books, Fermentation as Metaphor. Now, it is an entire book, but can you briefly explain from your experience as the fermentation expert and guru here why fermentation works as a metaphor for us as well?
Well, I mean, I certainly didn't make this up, but you know what, when I started to get interested in fermentation, as I became increasingly obsessed with fermentation, I started noticing, you know, when I was reading an article in the newspaper, you know, reading something in a magazine, reading a book, I would see references to, a period of great cultural ferment, artistic ferment, musical ferment, political ferment, spiritual and religious ferment. And what people mean when they use the word fermentation in this way is bubbliness, excitement, transformation. In the English language and a number of related languages, you know, the word fermentation, you know, can really mean any kind of bubbly phenomenon. And, you know, where the word fermentation comes from is the Latin fervere, which means to boil. And it's because, you know, before we had our scientific understanding of fermentation, fermentation was recognized by the bubbling. You know, when you're making beer or wine, when you're making bread, even when you're making sauerkraut, you get some bubbles. And so, you know, that's how people could tell the fermentation was active, was from the bubbles. And so, you know, we've really come to think of any kind of like bubbly phenomenon as fermentation. It has very, very broad, potential to use as a metaphor.
How fortunate are we to have had this hour with you, Sandor. I cannot thank you enough for sharing your expertise with us, your love of fermentation with us, and I very much hope we have this opportunity to speak again. Thank you.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me. And, I hope some of the people listening might check out my books, check out my website, and begin a fermentation practice in your home.
Well, we started the conversation with you talking about just talking about fermentation can make your salivary glands light up. And as we've been talking here, I've got to tell you, I'm looking forward to trying it because my salivary glands have been lit. So, Sandor, it's also now I'm hungry. So wildfermentation.com is the website, The Art of Fermentation, one book. Fermentation is Metaphor, another. Check him out online and hope to have him back soon. An update on the Larry Mueller Show at the Garden and Green Living Expo. Evidently, there's now a wait list for tickets, but do not wait any longer to get on there at wigardenexpo.com as it's Larry's second to last live broadcast in person coming up a week from Friday. Want to thank our team for who makes it all possible each and every day on the Larry Mueller Show. Clara Neipert, Joel Patinaw, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau, and of course, the man himself, Hall of Famer Larry Mueller, who returns tomorrow. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to the Larry Mueller Show.